welcome to the latest episode of The Booming Curmudgeon. We're going to be a little ambitious in this week's episode of The Booming Curmudgeon, and we're going to talk about two different topics. Both are topical for today's news cycle. It'll be fun to kind of just chew it up a little bit with you. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode. The two topics we're going to be talking about that are front and center in the news are this whole Ukraine peace agreement and peace negotiation and attempts by the Trump administration to elicit peace in Ukraine between Ukraine and Russia. The second topic is the most recent item in the news, which is the president's address to the joint session of Congress last night. It was very interesting. I stayed up late and watched it and have some thoughts on that. So without further ado, let's dig into the Ukraine peace process. So I watched with great interest the meeting between Trump and Vance and Trump's cabinet and Zelensky, which took place in the White House last week and kind of ran off the rails. It was very interesting, and I thought to myself, okay, something went astray. I noticed that there really are two schools of thought out there. They seem to be politically kind of separated in their view of this whole process with Ukraine. On one hand, you have the U.S., which has supported Ukraine with treasure and weapons, and even the sentiment of those that have been posting flags outside, "We stand with Ukraine," etc., and the Biden philosophy of "We're going to support Ukraine however long it takes, forever." That seems to be the thinking. It's a very emotional thought, I feel like. But then you have really the Trump approach, which is, hey, we've been in war too long, too many people are dying, and we need to bring this war to a stop because it's just going to end up being an endless war. I feel for Ukraine. I want to be very clear. I feel for Ukraine, the Ukrainian citizens, the fact that Russia invaded Ukraine, etc. And without getting into the politics of it, because I think you can get clouded by the politics and that'll drive the emotional argument of, hey, we're going to fight to the finish. But if you step away from that side of it and you stand back and you look at this situation, you really have limited ways that this thing can go. So I'm going to walk through them. Firstly, our options are to continue to fund Ukraine and continue to provide arms and allow them to fight their fight with Russia. That's the current path we're on. The debate is whether or not we continue down that path or whether we take a different path. If you're going to take a different path, you have probably a couple of options. There's the escalation option, which is to have the United States and European leaders agree to come join the fight. So in addition to money and arms, actually put boots on the ground and stand beside the Ukrainian soldiers and fighting Russia. The other option is to seek a negotiated peace. So I really think those are the three options. Continue as we're going. So option one, continue as we're going. Continue to fund Ukraine. Let them fight their war. We continue to support them with arms and treasure and allow them to do as well as they can do with Russia. I think the problem with that plan, which I'll call the Biden plan, because it seems to be what he was supporting. The problem with that plan is that I don't believe Ukraine can defeat Russia simply based on logic. Ukraine has a certain population of military-aged individuals, and Russia has demonstrably more of those people. So setting aside the will of both Ukraine and Russia and saying they're both committed to winning this war, yet neither side can actually get a strategic leg up on the other, that seems to me that you're really signing up for perpetual war. Okay, so that's how I see option one. Option two is we continue to support them with money and arms, but also throw in soldiers from the United States and European allies to go fight alongside them to give them effectively the numbers edge that they can go in and then, quote unquote, defeat Russia. Here's the problem with that strategy. Number one, I don't think you're going to have the will of the American people to send boots on the ground to fight with Russia. But even if we did, the problem with that strategy is we have to remember that Russia is a nuclear power, and you're really flirting with World War III at that point. So I don't think that's a viable option for that specific reason. I think we would be foolhardy to approach that. I think that you'd never get the political capital built up sufficiently to actually have those countries in a war status. not a peacekeeping status, but a war status to go in there and fight alongside of the Ukrainians in effectively the Ukrainians' war. And again, I'm setting aside motive. I think Russia was wrong to go and invade a sovereign country, but I think you have to step away and say, okay, well, but they did, and what are our options now? So option three is to bring the parties to a peace agreement, and that's the approach that the Trump administration is taking. I take President Trump as his word because his actions have aligned with his word, which is he wants the killing to stop. I know there's a lot of media and or Democratic talking points about Trump being in the pocket of Putin and all this. But when you hear Marco Rubio and you hear President Trump and you hear the administration talk generally about this peace process, which they're pursuing, they're trying to remain neutral. And the press and those that are against this and more for the Biden plan, if you will, are trying to goad the Trump administration into verbally talking negatively about Putin. That's what leads them to believe that he's in Putin's pocket, he's an enemy of the state, and he's a surrogate for Russia, etc. All of that diatribe. But when you hear the Trump administration answer that question, it makes perfect sense, which is if our objective is to have the parties sit down and have a negotiated peace, you can't actually do that unless you get both parties to show up at the table and go through the process of trying to come up with an agreement that all parties can live with to stop the fighting. It would do no good toward that end for the United States to badmouth Putin in the press, talk about him as a war criminal, the worst thing since Hitler invaded Poland, etc., and tried to take over the world. I agree with that. Those times can come if it goes off the rails and there's no peace to be had. You always have option one and option two to go back to. But I think the most desirable option is to actually stop killing Ukrainians and stop killing Russians and have everybody agree to stop killing each other. Hard to argue with that, honestly. But people will say, well, but he's not going to do it. He's not going to act in good faith. I think you can design a peace process that stops the killing in the short run and puts security provisions in place that will provide triggers. Should they walk out of the agreement, you never lose options one and two. And I think we have to trust the process. I can't imagine someone being against peace in the region. The objections are going to come. Russia doesn't deserve to have any land. They were the aggressor. They were in the wrong. Okay. Can we all agree on that? The problem is the war won't end if we don't come up with a settled agreement, because the alternative to that is someone has to win the war outright. And I don't see a scenario playing out where that happens. The over-under would say that Ukraine's going to lose. And then what? Ukraine loses everything. They lose a generation of men. You have 3 million people that can't return to their home country. Again, I'm setting aside the politics of it. I don't know enough of the politics. I know some, and I know both sides of the politics to some degree, or at least those that are reported in the press. And I've done a little research, but I stood away from that and said, okay, that really doesn't, I don't think it matters in whether or not to go for peace or whether to go for war. The why is less important. The fact of the matter is they're at war. So what now? Everyone has an argument against the other. Ukraine isn't innocent. I agree with that. Problem is, unless we're willing to go in and fight alongside them and take on Russia and effectively go for the all-out win, the war has a very high likelihood of just going on forever. And is that going to knock Russia down a peg? Is that going to hurt their economic status and whether or not they can continue to go on as a country? Yes. Is it going to do it enough for them to say, oh, sorry, just kidding, we're gonna withdraw completely and get out of Ukraine? I don't think so. I think it comes down to what can you achieve? And once you evaluate what you can achieve, you have to then pursue the best option there. I happen to think that achieving a negotiated peace where Ukraine gives up the least amount to Russia in some sort of settlement, and one that everyone can hold their nose and say, okay, let's stop killing each other, and here's the result of that negotiation, I think that's not a bad outcome. So that's my take on it. I'll give it a little analogy. I talked to my brother about this, and we had an interesting dialogue about it. But in my career, I had an organization that worked for me. And as with private companies, there are personnel matters that come up, and people are hired, people are fired, people don't do a good job, people do a great job. But when people aren't doing a good job and you have to take HR actions, sometimes people lose their job. You have to agree that you're not the right person for the job. We had an instance where there was a person working in one of the departments that reported up to me where we terminated that employee for performance-related issues. It turned out that this employee, or former employee, I should say, filed a discrimination claim with the body in the state we were in that governed such things. And adjudicated such things. So it was claimed to be a wrongful termination, and the reason stated was that this person was a member of the LGBTQ+ community, and it was alleged that that was the reason they were terminated. And as the responsible officer in the company, I was charged with managing the process from the company's side to defend. And further, I was actually the officer that met with this employee and terminated them based on their performance reviews, etc. And the interesting thing to me is that I had firsthand knowledge that the reason we terminated this employee was for performance-related issues, not for cause. They didn't do anything wrong. They just weren't good at their job. And they were terminated because of that. So I knew it wasn't for the reason that they alleged, because I technically terminated. It never came up in conversations. I had no idea the sexual orientation of this employee. So it was one where we were unjustly accused, we being the company, was unjustly accused of terminating this employee for discriminatory reasons. As we met with our attorneys in preparation for the hearings on this, it was one of those things where I actually took it personally, because I literally was the person that met with this employee along with their manager and terminated their employment. I know that we didn't terminate them because of their sexual orientation. So I took offense with the notion of being accused of doing it for that reason. I did take it personally because of that. I think that's just a normal human reaction. A little bit of a strange analogy as I'm telling it, but I think I'll try and drive it home here. She was in the wrong. I knew she was in the wrong. It's something worth fighting. And I was ready to fight. It was going to cost the company about probably $70,000 to $80,000 to defend it and pay for attorneys to go through the process. And they were prepared on the other side to settle for $30,000. And it was wrong. It was a wrongful accusation. It was not true. It was, in my opinion, worth fighting. But here was the thing. I had to take the responsible position, say, what's in the best interest of the company? And what's in the best interest of the company? Because none of this was going to be public information. It was a hearing, and it was we were encouraged to negotiate by the folks that ran this agency, the discrimination agency that was kind of looking at the hearing. Our attorneys, to their credit, were wise in recommending that we settle. Cut the check for $30,000 and be done with it. As much as that pained me to do it, it was the right decision to do. So to some degree, I kind of take that situation as analogous to what's going on in Ukraine. Russia was wrong to invade Ukraine. They were completely in the wrong. People have died. Stakes are really high. It was the wrong thing to do. And yet, I have a perspective that it would be in the best interest of both countries, specifically Ukraine, because they were the ones who were invaded. What's in their best interest? Is it to go on because you hate the other party, knowing that thousands of your citizens and soldiers will continue to suffer through a war and be killed? Or do you hold your nose and say, let's come up with a negotiated settlement? A negotiated settlement where both parties don't feel good about it is probably the right place it will land, which is nobody's happy about the settlement. And I think it ends the fighting, it saves lives, it removes the risk of World War III. I think those objectives suggest very strongly that the approach of the Trump administration to this problem is sound, and it's based on logic and trying to save lives of the citizens of Ukraine. It would have the tangential outcome of saving additional lives of soldiers in Russia. Nobody's mother wants to be sending their kids into this war that effectively can't be won by either side. I'd like to see where this approach comes out. I think the meeting with Zelensky went off the rails for the reason that Zelensky is emotional. He hates Putin. He doesn't trust Putin. Putin's in the wrong. All those reasons that I wanted to go on and fight the accusation that the company I worked for was facing are the same reasons that Zelensky has difficulty saying, yes, let's negotiate a settlement where somehow Russia wins something. I understand those feelings, but I think that he's coming around based on what I heard at the president's address last night before Congress, that Zelensky is recognizing that he's going to have to step away from those feelings and say, what's in the best interest of everybody here? Not what do I want and what do I emotionally want to do, which is to fight, but what's in the best interest of my country and my fellow citizens of Ukraine long term? And I think it's worth pursuing, because I think there are really only three potential outcomes that I reviewed at the beginning of this segment, and that is fight a forever war, have the U.S. and Europe come in alongside us and increase high risk of World War III and particularly nuclear weapons, or option three, which is come to the peace table and have the war stop I suspect that if they're able to pull that off, it will involve Ukraine giving up some segments of land to Russia. I believe that would also come with some level of security for Ukraine, particularly if the U.S. has interests in Ukraine that survive the negotiated settlement with respect to the mining rights for rare earth metals and other interests that are currently under discussion. And it sounds like they've moved forward away from the blow up in the Oval Office. It sounds like Ukraine is ready to go on that deal, and they may be seeing the forest through the trees now. Hopefully, they're able to proceed. It's probably 50-50 at this point. I'm not sure Russia's going to come in and play nice. I know they won't play nice. They're going to be looking after their own interests. Everybody wants to win. Even when you get to negotiated settlements, the perspective of the two parties or the two warring parties is going to be they want to win. The reality of a good negotiated settlement is that everybody loses. That's going to be a process to see if we can get to that point. But I'm hopeful. I don't want to see this war go on forever. And it's not for selfish reasons that we don't want to fund it. But let's be real. We don't have the money to fund it. We're printing money. We're $36 or $37 trillion in debt. We're trying to get out of it. Funding a forever war is not a good thing for this country. It's not a good thing for peace in the world. And I think we can do better than that. So that's my hope. Now to the second topic of today's episode, and that is the address by the President of the United States to the joint session of Congress last night, and that was on March 4th in Washington, D.C. at the Capitol building. I find the theater of this speech very interesting because, as I've discussed before, there is a big divide between the Democrats and President Trump and President Trump's agenda, and I think last night was a victory lap for President Trump. And effectively, he described all of his successes in the first 40-some-odd days of his current presidency. What I found interesting, you can agree or disagree with his policies or how he's doing things, but it's hard to look at what he's done in the first 40-some-odd days and say he's not active or he's getting nothing done. He's really got quite a lot accomplished, much of which he promised on the campaign trail. So for those that voted for him, he won the popular vote and the Electoral College by pretty wide margin, popular vote less so. But still, if his job is to exercise the will of the people, he ran on promises, he got elected by the people, and is implementing those policies and actually following through on things he promised during the campaign. When you look at the things he's working on and has focused on, border security, peace in the Middle East, peace in Ukraine, removing the DEI throughout government, no men and women sports. For the most part, all of these issues, save a couple, are effectively 80-20 issues, which is 80% of Americans support them, 20% don't. The speech was largely made up of discussion about what they're doing. DOGE was another one that was prominent. And honestly, I'm shocked at the Democrat Party for effectively just sitting on their hands all night. I mean, I've seen a lot of these joint session of Congress speeches by presidents, mostly their State of the Union, but because he's only been in office for a little bit more than a month, this first one is not considered a State of the Union, which is typical, but effectively it is that speech. It's his opportunity to take victory lap and to say what his agenda is for the country, much of which is to do things that are very popular among the people. And what surprises me is the Democrats are being obstructionists. It was almost embarrassing. I've seen a lot of these things, and even when there's a Democrat in government, and other than Trump, when a Republican's in office, the senators and the congresspeople, they may not support him, but they politely clap when you should clap, when there's something that's bipartisan and sure, this makes sense and it's a good thing. And isn't it great that, you know, hostages have come home, or isn't it great that this boy had cancer and now he's cancer free and he's getting a special badge from the Secret Service? I mean, how do you not clap for that? It's petty, it's beneath them. And yet there they were parading it around like that was a badge of courage or badge of honor that they're wearing at this thing. It was embarrassing. I don't know where the Democrat Party goes. The Republicans have seized upon this notion of common sense government. We don't want to waste money. We don't want to fund shrimp running on treadmills or other these crazy programs, you know, LGBTQ promotion in Burma or whatever these things are. And Trump listed a bunch of those. But that's common sense that we shouldn't be spending money on those things, isn't it? particularly where we have deficit spending. We have $37 trillion in debt, and we're trying to wrestle control. This notion of not supporting that is odd. So anyway, Republicans have branded themselves the party of common sense, the party of the people. And I think in this last election, you saw a lot of groups that historically had voted Democrat. There was large movements within those groups to vote Republican. And quite frankly, that's why Trump won, because of the movement in those subgroups. So African-American men, you had other demographics that shifted way more toward Republican than they had in previous elections. That alone was enough to move the needle for Trump, both in the Electoral College and in the popular vote. So here's the challenge for the Democrats. I think this is going to be fascinating to play out between now and the midterms, which is if the Republicans have branded themselves as the party of common sense, and they're going to govern based on common sense and based on what the people predominantly want and what they favor, kind of the 80-20 rule. If the Democrats are to oppose those things, what does that make them? Does that make them the party of not common sense? It's almost like they've been boxed out from being able to take policy positions on things that are opposed to the positions that the Republicans have taken. Beyond abortion, which is kind of a 50-50 issue still in our country, I can't think of any others at this point, but beyond those issues where we're kind of split 50-50 as a country, if the Republicans govern on 80-20 issues and say, we're going to close the border, we're going to deport criminal aliens that have raped and murdered people, I don't know how you oppose that with a straight face, let alone one that gets you anywhere with the voter. Even local elections have consequences, not to say that you have to run to the middle like you would in a presidential election. In a national election, you got to run toward the middle of the ideological political spectrum. But in local elections, you can say, I'm in Democrat country, so I can keep myself on the far left and run under a platform that basically lets my constituents know that I'm running to the left. Here's the challenge I think that the Democrats face in the midterm elections, which is these districts that they're in many cases, have been overrun by migrant communities that were let in under the open border policies of the prior administration. They've closed rec centers in these communities to house these migrant populations. They've devoted financial resources toward that. The numbers are staggering. What they were paying to house migrants in New York City is just unconscionable, that we would take $56 billion to these expenses. And you say, how do these communities wake up and say, yeah, I'm going to vote for the people that support that? I know we don't have a senior center anymore, and I know we don't have a community rec center, and I know that school is now a migrant shelter, and my kids don't have a place to play in the playground because we've got a male migrant shelter right around the corner. How do they go to their constituents and say, we're going to continue to support this because this is somehow a great thing? I think the American population has looked at the migrant crisis created over the last 4 years and said, no more. I think this notion of an American first agenda where we don't pay for everything in the world, let the other countries that are prosperous pay for those things too, and certainly pay their fair share. We hear from the left, the rich people should pay their fair share. It's not a bad position to say, but we do have a graduated tax system in our country where the wealthy do pay higher taxes as a percentage of their income. I know that there are exceptions based on the tax code that have been basically approved by all of the politicians that are in there because their donor class wants those tax cuts. But if I look at the Trump's tax cuts, the Trump tax cuts very favorably benefited the middle class and the working class. And I think that's lost on a lot of folks. I think the demonization of rich people in our country who fund entrepreneurial endeavors and our employers by and large is not really playing with the masses that well. They recognize that if a person making $50,000 a year gets a $1,000 tax cut, their previous tax bill may have been $2,000. So they have a 50% tax cut. Whereas let's say a rich person, someone making $500,000 a year, let's say he gets a $5,000 tax cut. His taxes the prior year may have been $30,000. He gets a $5,000 tax cut. And I'm understating that because I think his tax burden would be more than that, but just conceptually, that person had a 1/6, which is, I guess, like 23% tax cut, whereas the working class person making $50,000 a year gets a 50% tax cut. The problem with the way the Democrats are playing this is that they're looking at the absolute dollars and saying, well, no, that person got a $5,000 tax cut and the working class only got a $1,000 tax cut. So clearly the rich person got a bigger tax cut. That's not the way math works. On a dollar basis, yes, but as a percentage of their income, the working class person got a much higher tax cut. It's relative to their own tax burden. It's not relative to the amount of taxes that the rich person has saved. The rich person is going to view that $5,000 tax cut in the context of their world as a smaller tax cut than the lower class people. And here's the thing, they don't, and I say lower class, not lower class, but just the lower socioeconomic person who makes less and pays less taxes, the rich people don't object to that. They recognize that they're okay with the working class person getting a 50% tax cut and they're only getting a 23% tax cut. That, in their eyes, is their fair share, which is we pay larger dollars in taxes, we paid larger percentage in taxes, this is from the perspective of the wealthy, than the people in the working class, and they don't object to that. So when they're demonized as saying they're not paying their fair share, which by the way, no one ever articulates what's their fair share. I believe their fair share is if they're paying a higher tax rate than someone who makes less money than they are, our tax system does support that. Are there exceptions and you're going to find someone who makes a certain type of income and doesn't pay as high a tax? Yes. We always hear about the exception, but the vast majority of taxes are paid by the top 10% of wage earners and taxable income earners. That's just the truth. So it's disingenuous to suggest that they're not paying their fair share. It's even more disingenuous when you vilify the higher taxpayer with this, you got to pay your fair share, because I guarantee you from their perspective, they are paying their fair share. And to then never say, what is their fair share? They never have an answer for that because they just want to vilify. They're playing it to an uninformed electorate that hears, whoa, they got a $5,000 tax break and I only got a $1,000 tax break. And all of a sudden you have the victim and the oppressor model, which is to simply pit ourselves against each other in a country where we do have different levels of outcome and different levels of revenue and income. I got off on a tangent. I apologize for that. But back to the State of the Union. I don't know where the Democrats go. They seem to be on the wrong side of a lot of 80-20 issues. They're going down fighting, and I'm not sure what they're fighting. The will of the people says these things are good. I'm happy with the speech. I'm happy with what he's doing. I'm happy with what his administration is doing. And I know there are exceptions. I have friends on the left that think he's a buffoon, that think he's going to ruin the country. And I empathize with them because they do believe it with all their heart that it's a travesty. They react very emotionally to it. They don't really approach it from a sense of logic, what makes sense, and the fact that we're not going to ruin our country in 4 years. They just don't want to give him a chance. I have some level of empathy for them because these are people that I love and people that I consider to be great friends. And oftentimes it's people I knew in my 20s. And we've kind of diverged from really not caring about politics in our 20s to now I've leaned more to the right. They've leaned more to the left, but they're way more emotional than I am about it. And I don't quite understand that. I can look at the same set of facts and be very optimistic about where our country's heading. They look at the same set of facts that I'm looking at, and it is Armageddon. I mean, we have Hitler in there. We have this threat to democracy, all the rest of it. And all I see is a president who's trying to restore absolute free speech in our country, the one who is trying to be fully transparent in giving press conferences, apprising the American public about what's going on and what they're doing. A lot of things that we've not had in the government, certainly for the last 4 years, but even traditionally, he's opening it up and saying, here's what we're doing. The whole DOGE effort. Yes, people are going to be hurt. People are going to be laid off. But every company I've ever worked for can lose 10% of its workforce. No problem. And still get the mission done. Yet that happens in private sector all the time. People go through layoffs, they realize they're not making their budget, and they have to lay people off because you either have more income to cover your expenses based on how you've projected, or you have to figure it out somehow, how to balance your budget, how to make sure that you're living within your means. You either raise more money or you cut your expenses. They're going to cut expenses, and they're trying to cut it smartly and in a make sense way. I think that's playing well in the public domain. For the most part, there is a group of people in our country that believe that this is the worst thing ever. We have an unelected guy who's controlling the government. That's just talking points, folks. Our form of government has one person who's elected nationally. It's the president of the United States. I shouldn't say that. There's two. There's the president and the vice president. They're the only ones that are elected on a national ticket in every state of the union for a national election. The executive branch of the government consists of the president and a whole lot of other people, none of which are elected. So So this business of Elon Musk is not elected and wine. That's how the constitutional republic works. That's what Article 2 of the Constitution talks about, is vesting the executive branch power in a president. And in order for that person to exercise that power, they are able to hire people, they are able to fill positions, none of which are elected. The vast majority of people who work in government are not elected, and they're making decisions all the time. They're executing policy, they're making recommendations to decision makers. So the business of always unelected and he's a co-president and all this business, that's just resistance. And I don't know why they're resisting. So you're not against funding these crazy expenditures that were flowing through USAID? I think we got to give his administration a chance. We're 40 days into this and they're all complaining about the price of eggs? Are you kidding me? That's such a lame talking point. It's such a lame thing. I know they're going back to Trump, and Trump speaks with hyperbole. So I get it when he says, I'm going to lower the prices on day one. And they're all like, they all get in their little cluster. And, oh, it's day one, and then where are the egg prices? And I have buddies of mine that are, but what about the price of eggs? And it's just so juvenile and so simplistic and so not on point. It doesn't reflect the way the world works because Trump said it. And yes, he's hyperbolic. And yes, he's got an ego. And yes, he's full of himself. Okay, I grant you that. Did anyone believe that he was going to lower the price of eggs on day one? No. I don't honestly believe he's going to lower the price of eggs. What'll happen is the market will take over. We killed millions of birds to address bird flu during the Biden years, which is the right thing to do. But in its consequences, the price of eggs went up, and until you can restore the supply of layers for eggs and the egg industry comes back, prices will stay where they are, or they'll go up a little bit more or whatever. It's the way the economy works. So someone holding Trump to a promise about eggs is just silly. He was a guy being hyperbolic on the campaign trail. And inflation is that way too. Prices generally go one way. They go up. When we had the massive inflation during the Biden administration, you know, the price of X goes up by 30%. Are we really going to see those prices go down? It's not really the way the economy works. You have to have negative inflation. That's not a thing. What you can do is you can slow the rate of inflation, which is how much will it be next year versus this year. We've always had inflation, but how high is it? The issue is prices don't go backwards. It's not the way it works. We're still deficit spending. We're still spending $1 or $2 trillion more per year than we bring in. That in and of itself is inflationary. The biggest thing Trump can do is balance the budget. He's taken a hacksaw at it. There's going to be some pain along the way. He's not going after Medicare. He's not going after Social Security. He's trying to save them. Let's give him a chance. He's not going to blow up this country. So the Democrats, I think they're shooting themselves in the foot. They're going to have nothing to run on. If all they can do is run on, it's not Trump, we're not Trump, and everything Trump does is bad, and then you sit listening to a speech where he's describing things that are actually good and that the American people support, and the Dems still take their position that if Trump is doing it, it's bad on its face. It's so unintelligent, and it's so juvenile, and it's so middle school. When they sit on their hands, they literally couldn't clap and give a bit of respect to Lakin Riley's mom and sister, or the Nungri mom, or the boy who had cancer. And when Trump said, I can't say anything, and I wouldn't get a clap from the Democrats. And I think that's true. They've got a serious case of Trump derangement syndrome. I used to laugh at that term, but I think it's a thing. When you look at something that's provably good, and they won't clap at it because Trump said it, that's Trump derangement syndrome. Sorry. This little sweet boy that was diagnosed with cancer 5 years ago, and he's excited about being a policeman, and Trump has his Secret Service guy make him an honorary Secret Service agent, and just the joy in that boy's face, or the other boy who made the military academy and he was told that he was accepted. How do you not clap for that as a matter of decorum? It's such a bad look. I don't understand it. I don't think they get it. They don't have a strategy. They don't know what to do. They don't know what to do. The only thing they have is it's not Trump. Anything Trump says, we're against. I don't even care if it's demonstrably good. We're against it. What a horrible position to be in. You can probably tell from my take that I thought his speech was a big success. It gets snarky at points, and I think his delivery style where he reads the speech and then he drifts off and freeforms it, that's annoying. It's kind of an idiosyncrasy of his that I've just gotten used to. It extends out the length of time on the speech unnecessarily. I think he likes to freewheel it. He thinks it makes him look more personal or more relatable. I just think it smacks a little egotistical. But again, that's a stylistic thing, and I kind of look through that and say, what's going on policy-wise? Oh, you're cutting expenses. Okay, great. You closed the border. Great. We're deporting murderers and rapists. Great. We're doing the things we promised in our campaign to the people who voted us into office. Okay, I can get behind all of that. And do I care that he's a little bit of a narcissist when he freeforms it and kind of pats himself on the back and talks about it being the greatest thing ever and so forth and so on? I think you just get used to that and it's okay. It's like your crazy uncle that acts a little weird at parties. You just kind of, you still love your uncle, even though he's a little bit of a weirdo. But that's okay. I think Trump's doing a good job. I think he's working hard. I think he's getting a lot done. I think he's going to have people shooting arrows at him from the bureaucratic state, because the bureaucratic state is a thing. The amount of trillions and millions of and billions of dollars that are being spent on things that are worthless and not worth our taxpayers' money, or in this case, our debt money, because technically we're borrowing to pay for these stupid things. We have leaders in our country that can't look at that and say, you know, that's wrong and we can get behind this. They're more concerned with, I don't know what they're protecting. With a straight face, they can't say those things that the president articulated that they've cut in the speech last night. I never hear someone defending the expenses. I hear them attacking the messenger. That's always a sign that they really don't have a policy position. If they can't accept something that is demonstrably good, and even if we can debate about whether it's being done the right way, they're vilifying the people that are actually doing it. It's like being mad at the auditor who's auditing your bank and finding that someone's stealing money out the back door, and you get mad at the auditor, not the bank. Strange. Don't get it. Don't understand it. Except I point to Trump derangement syndrome. Trump touches it. It's bad. On its face, it's bad because of that. And that's a losing proposition. I think you're going to lose your base, Democrats. I think they're going to wake up and they're going to start to say, wait a second, he's getting stuff done. Wait a second. He's pursuing things that I support. Okay, maybe I can get behind that. I think in the election, he won over portions of constituencies that were traditionally Democrats. And I think it's because the Republicans have taken the high ground, which is common sense, and the Democrats in a two-party system have to be somehow against that. And it's going to be difficult to be the party that's against common sense. And I think it's unfortunate for Democrats. They could lose their brand. I think they've already lost their brand. Now they don't have a brand, and their brand is going to be it's not Trump. And I think they'll have difficulty winning elections. Maybe not in a purely blue urban areas, but I think in any of the more moderate Democrat areas, I think the trends that we saw in this last national election, I think will take more root, not less root. It's Trump's and the Republicans to lose if they don't keep their act together and keep heading in the direction that they've kind of set this agenda out. And if it derails the agenda and they're not able to solidify some of these efforts to fulfill promises legislatively with tight control of the House and a little less tight control of the Senate, they can't afford to lose a lot of votes on the Republican side if they want to pass the agenda items legislatively. But if they can keep their act together and get some of these things done, and those things lead to prosperity, I think of the amount of investment that's been promised in building manufacturing, and even that semiconductor chip company from Taiwan that's going to build a factory here in the U.S. This is all good stuff. And this is all stuff that heretofore, if we want to invest in things like infrastructure or building out industries, that was going to be on the dime of the taxpayer. And now it's not. It's private investment. So this is right in the wheelhouse of the direction we should be heading if we really want to restore manufacturing in this country. I think the tariffs, it's too new to tell for me on that. I have a sense of where he wants to go on that. I don't think he wants to go full on trade war. I think that he just wants fairness in the tariff situation around the world. I'm going to give him, like I would any politician slash leader, leeway to try what they believe is right and what they believe their advisors are helping them to achieve. Let's give him a little room and see how it goes rather than just be against it because it's Trump. I know he has a way about him. It can be very off-putting to many, but what I see as a guy who's elected, he's working his butt off. He is getting stuff done. He's doing it through executive action. He is taking the powers that are vested to him under whatever article gives the president his powers. He's doing that. We've got to get our legislative act and codify these things legislatively so that they actually become law and would have to be undone by future Congress. Otherwise, they'll just melt away when Trump's done, particularly if the Republicans don't maintain control. So I want to give it a shot. I'm very optimistic about where this country's heading. I was not over the last 4 years. I think we had an absentee president. I think we had people running the country that weren't the president, and he didn't have a clearly articulated mission. Certainly not one that the American people by and large had signed off on. And for the most part, he appeared to be asleep at the wheel and or compromised cognitively and energy-wise, etc. I don't think you can say that about this president. So let's give him a chance. I'm certainly going to. It was a very interesting speech to the joint session of Congress. I thought it was a good speech. It was uplifting. It was optimistic. I liked it. I think the Democrats embarrassed themselves, and I think they will live to regret that. They'll still have their base. Their base is out there. I have friends that are part of the base and that have serious case of Trump derangement syndrome, and I feel for them. But our country is strong. Let's keep going. There are many people in this country that disagree with me, but I never say they don't have the right to have a different opinion than me. And we do govern by kind of the majority rule. And if you look at the things he is governing based on, there's a lot of support for the actions he's taking. And I recognize that there may be 20 or 30% of the population that is against it. There's probably 10 to 25% of the population that are in that group that are against some of these things, and maybe one or two of them. Some of them, they seem good, but there is definitely a Trump can do no right group out there. And I think that's okay. It's a free country, but we also have elections, and I think that's going to have consequences. The position the Democrats are taking with respect to just obstructionists against everything Trump's trying to do, I think it's going to bite them in ways that they don't want to be bitten. I think it would be nice as a citizen of the country to see some bipartisanship in many of these areas. And unfortunately, we're not seeing that. I don't like that, particularly when we're trying to do good things for the country and or our leaders are trying to do good things for the country. It's difficult when you put up such a headwind for them to actually accomplish something. We're so used to government not accomplishing things or boasting about things that aren't real. It's nice to see things happen. As Trump said yesterday, the border's closed. 98% down in crossings. Policy's important. It wasn't you needed legislation to do it. You needed a different president and someone with the will to do it, and it can happen. So with that said, I'm going to sign off for now. Let's see how the next 12 months go. Let's have another conversation about Trump's report card at the end of this year and Congress's as well. We'll be in another election cycle, I think, in about a year and a half, to where we'll be able to talk about whether or not the Republicans maintain the control of the House and Senate. I think that's going to be a big portion of the second half of Trump's term, because I guarantee you, if they lose control of the House and Senate, he will be a lame duck 2 years into his term. So I don't like when anyone's a lame duck, because it just means we don't get anything accomplished for 2 years. And that's never a good thing for the country. So I wish you all well. Have a great week. I hope you're having a fabulous day. I hope you have a blessed life. And I thank you certainly for listening in to my measly little podcast. Take care.